Well, hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Brothers Grimm. So I got a question for you guys. Have you ever had a computer virus come into your computer, wreak havoc, and just completely mess things up? You lose files, you lose photos, you lose whatever. Like, have you guys ever had something like that happen, you know, since you've kind of had your own computers and stuff?
Never, because I have Macs, and Macs don't get viruses.
That's fair.
So the laptop I had before I got my first Mac back in like 2003 or four, that happened too.
What'd you do? Were you able to get anything back? Or
we had to basically wipe the hard drive to get the virus off there, and yeah, I didn't recover anything.
Mm.
I have dealt with a corrupt video file.
Yep.
Premiere file. And that's like the worst feeling in the world when it like corrupts and you're like, oh gosh, hopefully the recovery, you know, the backup recovery file worked. And but that's the worst I've had.
Yeah. Fortunately, a lot of those softwares, even like our recording software, it will actually, it gives me like auto saved files that I can always go back to if something happens. But when that happened, Jeremy, to your computer, did it start running slow? Did it like, how did you know that this happened?
Oh yeah. I mean, well, it wasn't a really fast computer. It was like 2002 Dell laptop that was like probably 20 pounds. I mean, it ran slower than normal. It probably didn't help that I had LimeWire on there running in the background, but yeah, it started running really slow.
But as one would,
so many tracks being downloaded at one time.
As one would, though, in the early 2000s, LimeWire was a thing.
If I was to get a virus, I would hope that the virus maker would be funny enough for it to like pop up on my screen as Dennis Nedry from Jurassic Park when he's going, you didn't say the magic word.
Absolutely.
I would hope for that.
That would be nice. That would be nice. Well, imagine being at 18 years old on a computer in the mid-1980s at your university. You're staying up all night playing Prince of Persia, Elite, or Wasteland when you should be preparing for your next exam. And all of a sudden, your computer just begins to run really slow, basically freezes.
That would suck. Also, what were some other fun 80s video games? Was Oregon Trail 80s or is that 90s?
No, that was maybe late 80s, early 90s. I mean, Atari was really big.
Yeah.
Computer games weren't as big.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, Atari was pretty awesome.
Yep, I would agree. I never really played much of those. I'm a little bit younger, but I have high appreciation.
Your first system was probably a Nintendo, Super Nintendo?
It was the original Nintendo.
Nice. Yep.
And then I upgraded to the 64 a few years later.
We never had an Atari at our house, Jeremy.
No, we started off with a Nintendo.
Yeah.
We were a Nintendo family for a long time till we went the PlayStation route.
That's right. Well, I don't think we had a personal computer either for a long time.
We had our family computer, like our big desktop, and then I had one in my room, and then I got a laptop.
Yeah,
and then I inherited yours that was in your room into my room.
Listen, you're the younger brother. That's just kind of like the dice that you were given.
I did. So I did get a Sega Genesis several years later.
All right.
My dad was like, "Oh, we need to get this." We were at like a thrift store somewhere, and we ended up buying one. And the thing was fun. It was cool.
Nice.
But I also enjoyed the massive Nintendo, the hand, just like the little Game Boy, but like the big one.
Yeah, the big gray one.
Yeah.
The original.
Yeah.
That seems original huge. Game Boys.
No backlight.
No backlight.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
It's great. Well, so for this episode today, it is not necessarily one-on-one crime or no one was killed, but when we're talking about the 80s, I couldn't help but think about how computers and technology started to become available to your average person. So I found the story and I was like, we got to share it. According to the FBI.gov, at around 8:30 p.m. on November 2nd, 1988, a maliciously clever program was unleashed on the internet from a computer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. This cyberworm was soon propagating at remarkable speeds and grinding computers to a halt. "We are currently under attack," wrote a concerned student at the University of California, Berkeley. In an email later that night, Within 24 hours, an estimated 6,000 of the approximately 60,000 computers that were then connected to the internet had been hit.
The internet was relatively young here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, my knowledge of internet history is probably about the extent of Halt and Catch Fire on AMC. That's about as much I know about the internet right. in the 80s.
Right.
Yeah, it was very rudimentary. Computers were super expensive back then.
Hmm.
Yep.
And you said there were how many computers connected to the internet?
6,000 of the 60,000 that were connected to the internet.
Wow.
So, what was that, 10%?
Yeah.
It's wild. So, computer worms, unlike viruses, do not need a software host, but can exist and propagate on their own. Berkeley was far from the only victim. The rogue program had infected systems at a number of the prestigious colleges and public and private research centers that made up the early National Electric Network. This was a year before the invention of the World Wide Web. Among the many casualties were Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, Johns Hopkins, NASA, and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
I don't really understand the motivation behind a worm or a virus that would like just destroy the computer. Like I understand modern viruses, you know, mining for information, but like just to destroy the computers, what's the motivation behind that?
You cripple the infrastructure, man. You cripple the network. You cripple the machines connected to the internet. You cripple the internet because it becomes useless.
But why?
Why not? I'm saying if my goal is to cripple something, I'm not just going to take out the network. I'm going to take out the device attached to the network.
But like, what are you trying to cripple? Like, why would you want to cripple?
Maybe it's an act of domestic terrorism. Maybe it's somebody just wanting to wreak havoc. Some people just want to watch the world burn.
Yep. And I feel like that's what's common these days is just to wreak havoc on people.
I guess so.
And like, what happens when they hit our grid?
Right.
You know, and I mean, that's happened before, but fortunately it hasn't like taken everything down.
I think there's a few more than 60,000 computers.
Yeah, there's a lot. Most people, I mean, everybody has a cell phone now.
Right.
It's a computer. Think about this too. This is 50 years ago.
Right.
It's amazing how far we've gone from technology from 50 years ago.
So it originated at MIT, right?
Yes. So the worm only targeted computers running a specific version of the Unix operating system, but it spread widely because it featured multiple vectors of attack. For example, it exploited a backdoor in the internet's electronic mail system and a bug in the Finger program that identified network users. It was also designed to stay hidden. So in computer networking, the name Finger Protocol and the Finger User Information Protocol are simple network protocols for the exchange of human-oriented status and user information. Very basic stuff back then, and I guess even to today. The worm did not damage or destroy files, but it still packed a punch. Vital military university functions slowed to a crawl. Emails were delayed for days. The network community labored to figure out how the worm worked and how to remove it. Some institutions wiped their systems. Others disconnected their computers from the network for as long as a week. The exact damages were difficult to quantify, but estimates started at $100,000 and soared into the millions. It's crazy to think that only 60,000 computers were connected at this time.
It's scary to think what would happen if a virus like that was unleashed.
Yeah.
We have a lot of modern protocols that stop that kind of thing, but I mean, imagine a virus that can't stop. You have to disconnect everything.
Right.
To stop it.
Yeah. And then at that point, your computer's kind of done. You got to basically either wipe it completely clean or get a new one. Mm. As computer experts worked feverishly on a fix, the question of who was responsible became more urgent. Shortly after the attack, a dismayed programmer contacted two friends, admitting he launched the worm and despairing that it had spiraled dangerously out of control. He asked one friend to relay an anonymous message across the internet on his behalf. With a brief apology and guidance for removing the program, ironically, few received the message in the time that the network had been so damaged by the worm.
My man thought that an apology sent on behalf from somebody else was enough. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, y'all.
I'm sorry. It was me.
We did it. Oopsies.
Yeah. But the ironic thing is, because of this virus, people weren't getting the emails that he asked the friend to send.
How ironic. I feel like this is one of those scenarios where, like, the guy probably did not even intend for it to be, like...
Right.
He probably just wanted to screw with somebody else. And he was like, oh, that multiplied. Oh, oops. Oh, I don't know how to stop it.
Yeah. Well, think about it. So...
Oh, it's gone.
1988, he's at MIT, or he either just graduated or just attended MIT, and he's bored at home... creating whatever this is just for fun. And
what was he dismayed about? Did they say?
Didn't say.
I bet he was mad at like a girlfriend or something.
Maybe. Yeah.
He probably only made it to try to like target one computer. And because the internet was so new, probably didn't realize how it would travel
right
as quickly as it did.
Yeah. And they said like it just started multiplying on itself.
Yeah.
And just becoming stronger and stronger and stronger.
I mean, it's, we know that how quickly information can travel now because of the internet, but we've also had it for the last, you know, 30 something, 40 years.
Right.
So, and with wireless internet and everything that goes with that, it's just like instantaneous.
Yeah.
They was brand new. They were probably very naive to what could actually travel through an, you know, across a network.
And there's no virus protection at this time. So independently, the friend who was asked to make this email, he made an anonymous call to the New York Times, which would soon splash news of the attack across the front pages. The friend told a reporter that he knew who built the program, saying it was meant as a harmless experiment and that its spread was the result of a programming error. So that goes back to some of our theory of he was smart enough to create this, but not smart enough to make it safe. I don't know how a virus can be safe, but...
Well, you created on an air-gapped computer, which has never been connected to the internet, and it's not connected in any way. That's the only way you can keep a virus from getting out.
Right, and you just test it on your own machine. Mm-hmm. In a follow-up conversation with the reporter, the friend inadvertently referred to the worm's author by his initials, RTM, or Robert Tappan Morris. Using that information, the Times soon confirmed and publicly reported that the culprit was a 23-year-old Cornell University graduate student named Robert Tappan Morris. This cyberworm was soon propagating at remarkable speeds and grinding computers to a halt. "We are currently under attack," wrote a concerned student at the University of California, Berkeley. Morris was a talented computer scientist who had graduated from Harvard in June of 1988. He had grown up immersed in computers thanks to his father, who was an early innovator at Bell Labs. At Harvard, Morris was known for his technological prowess, especially in Unix. He was also known as a prankster. After being accepted into Cornell that August, he had been developing a program that could spread slowly and secretly across the internet. To cover his tracks, he released it by hacking into an MIT computer from his Cornell terminal in Ithaca, New York. After the incident became public, the FBI launched an investigation. Agents quickly confirmed that Morris had been behind the attack and been interviewing him and his associates and decrypting his computer files, which yielded plenty of incriminating evidence. Are you just going to leave your computer out or leave it on this? Like Jeremy was saying, he should have had like an isolated computer that he'd tested everything on, not his like everyday personal get up.
Well, and personal computers back then were gigantic. They weren't, you know, they weren't laptops, you know. Maybe there were, but they were like suitcases.
It's like ridiculous. He should have been in like a server room somewhere. The question arose, had Morris broken federal law? Turns out he had. In 1986, Congress had passed the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, outlawing unauthorized access to protected computers. Prosecutors indicted Morris in 1989. The following year, a jury found him guilty, making him the first person convicted under the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Morris, however, was spared jail time. Instead, he received a fine of $10,050, 4 years of probation, and an order to complete 400 hours of community service. 400 hours is insane.
A lot of hours.
Yeah, it is.
But it's warranted, and I'm actually kind of surprised he didn't go to jail.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, NASA was some of the computers that he got into. And
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Not a good time to do this during the Cold War.
No, not at all. The episode had a huge impact on a nation just coming to grips with how important and vulnerable computers had become. The idea of cybersecurity became something computer users began to take more seriously. Just days after the attack, for example, the country's first computer emergency response team was created in Pittsburgh at the direction of the Department of Defense. Developers also began creating much-needed computer intrusion detection software. At the same time, the Morris worm inspired a new generation of hackers and a wave of internet-driven assaults that continue to plague our digital systems to this day. Whether accidental or not, the first internet attack 35 or so years ago was a wake-up call for the country in the cyber age to come.
Now, y'all know, y'all listening know, this is the Brothers Grimm, so usually we do things that are meant to be a little scary, and to be honest, this could be pretty scary. I mean, imagine, it's hard to imagine now, because everybody is connected to the internet. Everybody's connected in some way to a device or a computer, but imagine if there was a virus or a worm strong enough to take out every device, and at the speed of which things move now, everything is turned off. It would take a shutdown of the entire internet in this day, the entire internet, to stop something like that from happening. And I mean, we would go dark one way or the other.
Yeah, our world as we know it would be done right now.
You know, so much of our society is based on connectivity to the internet and communication with other devices, you know, and even like power, you know, it's not just like devices, but it's like our power grids are run by networks, you know, our sanitation is run by networks, you know, everything is run by computers and networks. So any sort of substantial attack to the nation's infrastructure, I mean, sends us back to the Stone Age.
Yeah. You know? I mean, think about the studio we're in right now. There's three computers on the table, two iPads, next door, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment. So it's like, if the network were to go down, we would be in trouble just from, like, putting on any sort of recordings, any sort of, like, live production, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. This reminds me of a Disney Pixar movie. I don't know if you've seen it, Ralph Breaks the Internet. So in the movie, spoiler alert, but Vanellope wants to leave her game and join this internet-based racing game, and Ralph doesn't want her to, so he launches an insecurity plugin into the game, and it gets out of the game, and it cripples the internet, and it ends up copying Ralph because he's so insecure, and so the entire internet just starts to break, one device by one device, site by site. All because, you know, it copied his insecurity and it just became this massive monster. And so I was like, you know, as you were talking, I was like, man, the correlation is crazy.
Mm. Yeah.
Because every site went down in the movie, you know, it would be catastrophic.
Yeah, it'd be wild for sure.
Well, I think the implications of losing that type of connectivity is more than just like we lost all of our devices, we've lost our control on that, on technology. It's more of like, the way that we survive now is like, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to, you know, I almost wouldn't be able to do my job.
Right.
I think a lot of people wouldn't be able to do their jobs. The economy would probably tank because so much of, you know, so much of this of stocks are wrapped up in technology based companies. And I mean everything is moving towards a tech based economy. Everything.
Well, you would see a worldwide collapse of society in general because,
right.
Like, if you think about, like, nuclear reactors all run on
some sort
connected
of
computers.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, nuclear, you know, facilities, silos, all, I mean, everything is run. And if you launch something that cripples every network in the world, you're talking about, I mean, nuclear reactor meltdowns. You're talking about, you know, warheads launching off. You're talking about power grids going down, food going out. You know, not to, you know, working is the last thing that I think any of us would probably be thinking about. If
yeah.
There was a show called, what was that show, Joe?
Revolution.
Yeah, Revolution, where these bugs came and they ate up all the power. And the society, I mean, when the power is gone, I mean, everything in our world runs off power.
Yeah.
Of some sort or another. Mm. And, you know, to think about what a world would be like without.
Without power, without technology is a little hard to imagine now.
Yeah.
It's hard to even think about the fact that, you know, we take advantage of the fact that we are extremely vulnerable and reliant and dependent on technology.
Yep.
In a very, very unhealthy way. As a race, as a world, we are very, very connected, and it has all the pros, but it also has a lot more cons than I think anybody wants to actually sit down and admit.
Yep. All it takes is one computer scientist to create a virus like this and take out the entire world.
Or one oopsie.
Yeah. Yeah. Big oopsie. Like I said, this isn't our typical Brothers Grimm episode, but I thought talking about the 80s and the kind of boom of technology that started, it was it was something I wanted to talk about for sure.
It changed the world.
Yeah.
It changed the world, and it is something that we are seeing the benefits of now.
Benefits and even side effects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't be listening to us right now.
That's right.
That's true. You're welcome.
That's right.
This episode was written by Brian McIntyre with discussion from Jeremy Thompson and Joey Thompson, and was recorded at Star Scream Studio. Grayson over at Star Scream is an incredible producer and engineer, so be sure to visit starscreamstudio.com for all your tracking and recording needs. Additional audio support by Will Compton, and original music composed by Nick McClure. Be sure to subscribe, and when you do, drop a line in the comments and say hi. We want to hear your grim stories too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.
Important security message. Your computer has alerted us that it is infected with viruses, spyware, and malware on your computer. If you close this page, you may be putting your computer at serious risk, and we may disable your computer to prevent further damages to our network.